Think about the last time you were facing a problem with your store or your business. It was probably today in the shower. How do I hire for this role, solve this problem with my paid campaigns? What instead of thinking, worrying, obsessing, zoning out during family dinners, you could just conjure up 10 super savvy experienced store owners to tell you exactly how they solve the problem. That's e-commerce fuel, our community of 1,200 seven and eight figure owners, the most experienced group of e-commerce and DTC owners online. Our super active discussion forum lets you do exactly that. There's hundreds of people checking and commenting every day, and questions that get posted often get dozens of answers within 24 hours from deeply experienced operators. In fact, we're so confident this will be a game changer for your business that if you join, stay a member for a year, and don't see a 10x ROI on your membership, then we'll refund all of your membership fees for the first year plus $1,000 for the hassle. So come join us. You can learn more and apply at ecommercefuel.com. The E-Commerce Fuel podcast is brought to you by One Click Upsell, the most popular, largest upsell app in the Shopify marketplace, trusted by over 11,000 users, over 1,900 of those big spending Shopify Plus stores, and they've generated over $200 million in revenue for the merchants that use them. And you may be thinking, oh, hey, Andrew, I've heard of One Click Upsell. I know these guys, but do you really? Do you know what they've rolled out recently? They've got some cool new stuff. For their pre-purchase and their post-purchase upsells, you can now select from multiple different offers to present your customers. So instead of having them just have to pick from one single thing, you can give them the option to pick from multiple upsells, which helps and has proven to increase the number of people who actually take you up on those upsells. So if you're not using upsells in your store, it's an amazingly easy, fast way to increase your average order value and your revenues. So check them out at ecommercefuel.com/upsell. Hey, it's Andrew here, and welcome to the E-Commerce Fuel Podcast, the show dedicated to helping seven and eight-figure brand owners build incredible businesses and amazing lives. And so glad to welcome back for the, 118th time to the show, good friend, and at this point, just, you know, straight up co-host, Bill D'Alessandro of Natural Dog Company and many other ventures. Bill, welcome to the show. And I have to say, man, I didn't think you were going to accept my $50 bribe to name your child Andrew, but like true entrepreneur hustling for the, I thank you for, that's so exciting.
Oh, well, I plan to lord it over your head forever. So I now you owe me one.
It is, but congrats, man. Third child, like, I don't know, 3 weeks ago. And yeah, big deal. And baby is doing happy and healthy, and mom is too, right?
That's right. Yeah, everybody's good over here. Three children is a bit of a zoo, but you know, it's what we signed up for. We're figuring it out. I've got going back to work probably next week or the week after. So I was able to take a couple weeks with the family, which has been nice.
Yeah, that's super nice. And you also have, for those watching on video, I know a lot of people listen to this on the podcast, but man, you were showing off your whole new shiny, like 60 Minutes, Dateline studio setup, lights, teleprompters. I mean, you look like you're ready to you know, broadcast or like moderate a presidential discussion over there. It's impressive.
Well, I needed a paternity leave project, right? Like I needed, like I wasn't working. So I was like, I got to do something. So I kind of dove into the, how do you do the, make the very best Zoom setup known to man? So if you're watching this on YouTube, you will see it. And we'll do a episode, or I'll do an article on Twitter or something about all the different pieces, the camera, the teleprompter, the lights, all that stuff.
Yeah, the teleprompter is super cool. You had to like take a picture and send it to me because my brain was not able to wrap my head around what was happening. But it looks fantastic, and it's so fun to go down the rabbit hole on that. We were joking about how like buying video gear in content marketing is akin to starting an LLC when you're getting your business going. Like, it's so easy to just waste time and feel productive. And it is, it's important, but like, man, I don't know about you. I tend to be a research maven. I can spend and justify spending like 10 hours researching gear, which is probably a hard
10 start. Hours. Please. That's rookie numbers. Whole months at a time and thousands of dollars to avoid doing the one thing that I should be doing, which is recording content for this course.
Well, today we're going to be talking about kind of something that was a huge part of our lives over the last, you know, I guess, three-ish years. And that was a deal, an ECF Capital deal that you and I and Mike Jackness and a handful of, probably 15 other investors in ECF Capital were a part of. And so we wanted to dive and talk about what happened, talk about the structure of the deal in as much transparency as we can talk about the economics of the deal, try to give you as much detail as we can with the exception of the name of the business and the exact niche, just out of respect for the owner, the new owner of the business, because we've since exited it. But yeah, and a lot of lessons learned, particularly investment lessons. Like this was, I'm going to be doing another episode in the future about kind of general lessons from ECF Capital and what that was. But in this deal in particular, because I think there's a lot of unique takeaways from it. So, but yeah, so to kick it off, Bill, what was the genesis that you remember of this deal? Like the first time you heard about it and kind of how it got kicked off?
Yeah. So, you know, we had several years ago, you had kind of concepted this idea of e-commerce fuel capital, where the idea was that we would circle up a bunch of experts from ECF who would bring money, acquire an e-commerce business, and then use our expertise to help that business grow and scale. And the idea that, you know, we would do it, you know, several times, kind of got commitments from everybody. And so we were out in market looking for a deal. And another ECF member actually was selling their business and kind of reached out to us and said, hey, you know, what broker should I use? Or, you know, I'm thinking about putting this on the market. Might you guys want to buy it kind of before it hits the market? And so we kind of looked at each other and go, oh, this is a good business. We respect the person that's selling it. You know, maybe this could be the first ECF Capital deal.
Yeah. And I think, you know, they came to us with that deal. And I think one of the first, I'm going to dive in, one of the first lessons, anytime you can do deals and invest with people that you have a deep track record and a lot of mutual trust with, it makes the deals so much easier. Like I think about that. We'll talk about this on the back end as things happen. I think with you and I and Mike, and there are some areas where kind of our history and that mutual trust help us get through some kind of harder areas. But even on the front end, I think this person I've known for a decade, and I think you have too for the most part, if not entirely. And just like even going through diligence, we did our diligence, but so much of diligence of buying or selling a company is trying to figure out, am I getting screwed? Are things being misrepresented, right? Like is, you know, where is the skeleton? Where are the skeletons in the closet? And knowing this person, again, we did our diligence, but it just made the process go so much faster, and having a higher degree of knew what we were buying, I think was a huge, that was one of the big lessons for me, this. Because I think you can go the other way too. Like, you know, the whole never get into business with family. And I think that's still a fairly good guidance, but I think in this case, at least, especially when you're buying a business, knowing somebody and their track record is tremendous. And also the value in the marketplace, if you have a great reputation, I think is paramount.
I mean, I think trust is sort of one of the key themes that ran all the way through this deal from the time we bought it to, you know, we're going to talk about the relationships between each other as we owned it and managed it and tried to sell it. And then even with the guy that bought it, you know, the level of trust that we were able to build with him. And just when you have trust between partners and that comes first, it makes everything so much easier.
Yeah. So I remember this deal came in, we looked at it, and from a financing perspective, the deal kind of really coalesced once Mike and I looked at it, were interested, but I think neither of us were able to, because for a deal structure, the way the deal structure ended up looking was the purchase price was about $3 million for this business. ECF Capital, you, Mike, and I invested about an average, like in aggregate, about $600K between the three of us. We raised about $600K from investors. That's 1.2 in equity. And then we took out an SBA loan for 1.8 mil, which you guaranteed. And so you had a lot more equity because you guaranteed your equity portion was, you know, was funded by the SBA loan and you had the equity, but you're also on the hook on the PG side for it. That was the deal structure. And then we had a bonus structure in place for Mike. He was the original plan was for him to come in, take over the business, transition it, set it up, be the CEO for 1 year. And then we'd run it for a couple of years after that and harvest some gains and build up the equity value and then sell it. And then he would get a bonus based on the performance, the IRR that we achieved. IRR is just a fancy, like internal rate of return. It's kind of like, you know, it's just the rate of return you realize on an investment when you consider the time and the compounding. So Bill, any thoughts on, I have a few, but I'm sure you do as well. Any thoughts on doing an SBA deal with lots of different investors in a deal like this? What were your takeaways from that?
So ultimately, the thing that enabled the deal was that in order to use an SBA loan, you need a guarantor. So I raised my hand to be the guarantor, which means the one guarantor is on the hook. You know, if the business goes bad and the loan defaults, like they come after your personal assets. So if you're going to be the guarantor, you know, you deserve compensation for the additional risk that you're taking. So I was compensated with additional equity in the business, a significant additional bump in equity you know, because I took on all that risk. But the way the cap table ended up working out was I was the only person on the cap table above 20%, any one person. And so per SBA guidelines, I was the only person that would be required to personally guarantee. And we structured it this way on purpose. Anybody below 20 is not required by SBA guidelines to personally guarantee. So we had a bank. This was in kind of timeline for closing was seller wanted to make sure they were out by the end of the year, by the end of the calendar year. We got it under LOI. I think it was in September. I mean, plenty of time, right? Picked a bank, you know, had an attorney and like, let's go, let's close this thing. We ought to be able to close it in plenty of time before the end of the year. Well, you know, everything's all set. And then, you know, the bank's attorneys are dragging their feet. It's December. And we were supposed to close first week in December. It's second week in December. And the bank says, we can't approve this. Quote, it looks like a private equity deal. And we said, well, what do you mean? And they said, well, there's all these external equity investors. And we said, I know, but there's no guideline against this in the SBA. This is perfectly allowed. Everybody's below 20%. And banks' internal legal counsel got uncomfortable with it. So we are 2 weeks from closing with a seller that we knew personally, and we had promised we would acquire their business by the end of the year because they had tax concerns that the tax rate was going to go up. All of a sudden, bank says, we can't fund your loan 2 weeks before the end of the year. So there were some very tense discussions. Of course, seller didn't want to do a seller note to bridge the gap. And we finally ended up with our lawyers browbeating the bank into doing it. And I was in Pennsylvania at my in-laws, and the notary had to come to my in-laws like 3 days before New Year's Eve to notarize everything. Go ahead. What did you want to add?
Well, I was going to say, yeah, the bank, it was kind of a double thing because I think the bank, first off, they said, you can't do this ECF. You can't do a private equity style investment, which it was this, it's a very micro private equity, but it's, you're pooling people's investors. And we had, so on my side, because kind of the way that was a lot of it was set up was I was running the ECF capital side. I was responsible for investors, all the legal side investors, you know, kind of relations with them, payments, everything. And so we had a dedicated investment vehicle. It's called a special purpose vehicle. And what that is more or less, it's just like an LLC that a bunch of members own and pool their collective money and interest in. And then they invest using that one LLC into the business. So we had that all set up, was all dialed in. I spent a bunch of time getting it dialed up. And that's where the bank came in and said, hey, sorry, you can't do this. So what we had to do, at least as part of getting that deal done, and this was like Christmas. This was like Christmas 2021. I remember it was like Christmas Eve day at like 3 p.m. and I'm out in my van because the office is closed and I'm like trying to call, I'm calling and texting all of our investors apologetically being like, hey, I'm really sorry to blow up your Christmas Eve, but I need you to sign like a new set of documents to get around it. Anyway,
right.
But it was just a nightmare. Anyway, but this the kind of the way to end it was, Bill, what we would close. We closed like on Christmas.
We closed on New Year's Eve. We closed on New Year's Eve. The deal closed on New Year's Eve, which was compounded by the fact that Mike Jackness, who was going to be our CEO, our friend, and great e-com operator, needed to be there on day one to tell the employees, hey, we own this business now. I'm your new boss. Mike lives in Nevada, right? In Las Vegas. This business was located on the East Coast. So several days before closing, Mike basically says, should I get in the car and drive? And Mike was going to drive cross country.
No. I think he was a third of the way there.
He was in Texas.
Yes. In Texas. So
he would check in with us every several hours and go, should I keep driving? Like, is this deal going to close? And we were like, yeah, keep driving. The deal didn't close until he was like approaching the Mississippi River as he was driving through Texas, not knowing if he was on a Don Quixote quest, you know, for a business we weren't going to own. So anyway, bottom line is, if you're doing an SBA deal and you have lots of small investors, you need the bank to explicitly in writing, the bank's legal counsel, to be okay with the large number of small investors, even if everything is to the letter on SBA regulations. And honestly, what it just came down to is bank's legal counsel didn't look at it until 72 hours before closing. Was exactly what it came down to. The bank had told us, yeah, we're all good. Bank's legal counsel actually hadn't looked at it and then threw up the red flags at the last minute. That was the cause of all of the pain in the butt.
Yeah. And this is something I learned from a different deal, but it's kind of salient to this point too. Even if we had done that deal the way we wanted to, if you're set up as an S corp, which many e-commerce businesses that are making probably over six figures are going to be set up as an S corp for tax purposes. If you are set up as an S corp, you cannot have a multi-member LLC invest into your S corp as a member. It's just disallowed by the IRS, and I believe, I'll have to spot check this because it's been a couple of years since I remember this, but I believe that forces you to convert from an LLC, a standard LLC, to a C corp. If that happens, like it's just mandatory, it converts you. So we're kind of getting in the weeds here legally, but that's something I learned later. And I think if we had done that as well and been structured as an S corp, that also would have been disallowed.
So we did get the deal done. $3 million purchase price, $1.8 million SBA loan, personally guaranteed by me, $600K of equity from kind of the three primary partners, you, me, and Mike Jackness, and $600K of equity, from kind of passive investors. The plan was Mike is CEO for the first year. There were a number of things about the business. We wanted to move some production to Asia. We wanted to relaunch their website. There were a number of things that the prior owner just basically said, I didn't want to pursue these. It seemed like too much effort. You guys should do these. So our plan was we're going to kind of pluck the low-hanging fruit here. Mike's going to be our activist CEO for the first year or so. Then we'll bring in a general manager. Mike is able to step back. And then after that, GMs have been in place for another year or two. So our hold period is approaching 2 or 3 years. At that point, we'll look to sell the business. SDE or EBITDA should be higher because of the things that we've done. We should realize a gain. Plus, we will have paid down some debt. So thus leaving more value for equity. Kind of your classic, I don't want to call it a private equity style fix and flip, but fix it, buy a business, make it bigger and better, sell it. The basic thesis.
Yeah. And I mean, the business I don't think it was a very well-run business when we bought it. It didn't need a lot of fixing, but I just think our big value adds were thinking of trying to increase margin through the sourcing, the supply chain, grow the off Amazon side of the business more than it was, and some other operational things. And so those were because it was already a really well-run business, but those were kind of the value adds we were hoping to bring to it. So we bought it, took it over. And a big thank you to Mike for coming in and running it, and did a great job. And so comes in. So at the year mark, you got to take your kind of 2024 hat off and put on your 2021 hat, where it was like the party was like full tilt, right? Like in terms of just M&A multiples, aggregators, just like things were just, it was frothy at almost, with retrospect, close to peak frothiness, but we can only say that now. And so we get close to maybe a year-ish in, and you and I and Mike look at this and say, multiples are looking really good. We don't know if they're going to go that much higher. Maybe we should look at selling this business right now.
What happened is we got an inbound inquiry from a strategic.
Oh, that's what kicked it off.
From a big strategic, cold called us and said, we'd like to explore buying your business. I'll make a long story shorter. We then engaged in a 9-month dance with this private equity group that owned a much larger business in the same niche. The private equity group had never done a deal in e-commerce, could not understand how Amazon FBA inventory worked, could not understand a lot of really fundamental things. They spent several $100,000 on diligence, which was absurd. They hired a dedicated technology diligence firm who came in and interviewed us, and they were like, so where's the servers? And we're like, you don't understand. It's Shopify. e-commerce business before. It was unbelievable.
Let me give you Toby's cell phone number. He can point you to where those are.
Right. So these guys were just so wrapped around the axle, and ultimately they couldn't get there. They ended up reducing their value to functionally nothing. And that structure was so unattractive. So we had to walk. So during all that time, now we've stretched past our original Mike as CEO for only a year. Mike is already past his kind of commitment that we had made. And then we said, maybe we should just hire a broker and sell this thing.
That's right. Yeah. And I mean, that's one of my big takeaways, and we can kind of keep sprinkling these throughout the story arc line. Man, I remember with one of the investors that the guy is a great, really smart, savvy investor. He was, I talked to him about investing in ECF Capital, being one of our ECF Capital investors. He was willing, but kind of gracefully bowed out. Anyway, that's beside the point, but we were sitting down talking about it, and he said, Andrew, like, one of the things I love about public market investing is if your investment thesis changes, if you just decide you need the money for something, I can just go to Fidelity and click a button and bam, I sell my Tesla stock, I sell my Shopify stock, whatever it is, and the money's in my bank. And he's like, until you've really been in it, I think sometimes it's hard to appreciate, or you will probably appreciate after this, man, the challenges of having illiquid investments. And there's a reason why illiquid investments have often higher IRRs over time is because, man, we spent from the time that we wanted to sell the business to when we actually sold the business, was it a year?
It was almost 2 years.
3 months?
It was almost 2 years. Almost,
yeah, maybe a little shy of 2 years, but it was a year and a half to 2 years. It was and a tremendous amount of work and also a tremendous amount of we went through, I mean, M&A is always an uncertain thing. But we went through multiple processes that did not work for various reasons. One time, one of the buyers had a kind of a really critical disease that popped up at the last minute.
The buyer got Lyme's disease and had to step back. He got Lyme's disease and said, I can't do any business. I'm functionally bedridden. I have to pull out of this deal. 2 weeks before closing, loan was approved and everything. So that was, 6 months with him. He bails. Then we switched brokers to the wonderful people at Quiet Light who we should have gone with at the very beginning. And the folks at Quiet Light did a great job of, taking the business to market again. We find another buyer who lives in the same town as the business is based in, seems like a perfect fit, has even run an e-commerce business before. But then we learn that he needed to sell one of his, we go under LOI. We learn that later he needs to sell one of his buildings in order to free up the cash to buy the business. The sale of his building falls through. He pulls out of acquiring the business. So we are now left at the altar by the private equity firm, left at the altar by Lyme's disease guy, left at the altar by can't sell my building guy. And Quiet Light and the folks at Ecom Lending together were able to find the guy who originally or eventually purchased it, our fourth buyer, to kind of step in halfway through the diligence and SBA process and kind of finish what couldn't sell the building guy started. And we finally closed in mid-2023. So our whole period was all of 2021, all of 2022, and 4 or 5 months of 2023. So 2.5 years, during which time Mike Jackness was the CEO the entire time. Bless him. Thank you, Mike. When he had only agreed to do it for a year, which kind of brings me to one of my biggest takeaways is that don't go into acquiring a business with a fixed timeline. The problem with this was, Mike's a busy guy. He has other things going on. He kind of said, I'll give you guys a year. But then when the year was up, we were for a year and a half later, always about to sell the business. So it didn't make sense to try to swap out the CEO. It didn't make sense to put a general manager on the books and take the SDE hit, which would affect the value of the business. So through circumstances that nobody could control, Mike got strung along for not 1 year, but 2.5 years. And we did give him a nice bonus to say thank you for doing that. But that was the source of a lot of consternation. Mike had other things going on. So the business that was taking kind of focus he didn't have really put him in a hard spot. So a big lesson for me is if you go into a business, acquire it, don't go in with yourself as temporary CEO, right? Go in, bring your management team in right away, or decide that you're CEO until the end of this thing. Going in with, an exploding CEO is never a good idea.
Yeah, thank you, Mike, for your flexibility and just the willingness to see that through, because you were in that seat for a year plus longer than expected. I think one of the other things that I learned from this was, and maybe this is getting maybe we're going to get too legalistic on legal structures here, I'm not sure, but there is a reason. Like, I always used to think the C corp structure was just this racket, right? You have to pay taxes at the corporate level and then you have to pay taxes again. Because the way a C-Corp works, the difference from an LLC, LLC is all passed through. So really nothing is taxed until it hits the owner individually and then they're taxed at the individual level. Whereas a C-Corp, you pay tax at a fixed rate, it's 21% of all profits. And then the corporation pays that tax. And then when it distributes out to its shareholders, they pay tax again, usually at the capital gains rate. So, which a C Corp, you're using it to pay 20% plus 20%. LLC could pay anywhere from 0% all the way up to, you know, 37% if you're at the highest tax bracket in the US at least. Anyway, I used to think it was a ripoff because you're getting taxed twice. But man, one thing I realized with a structure like this, you have, because you've got like, people have to make quarterly payments, all of the taxes flow through. And you think about an e-commerce business oftentimes, especially if it's growing quickly, you can have a lot of money on paper that is being made, but you don't have the cash because you're plowing it back in inventory, right? So as the person who's responsible for watching over the investors' interests, you know, we had some tax bills, some six-figure tax bills that came due. And not only do you have to like make sure that money is there from a planning perspective, but you also have to be sending out oftentimes quarterly distributions for people to pay their quarterly tax bills, you know, just to 15 people, which is not an insignificant amount of like admin. And this is a deal where it's not large enough to hire someone to do all this. And so a lot of it I was doing. Anyway, the LLC structure was just not, it made me really realize some of the benefits of the C Corp structure versus the LLC. Even, you know, if you pay a little bit more, but sometimes you don't even necessarily are paying more. Sometimes it's about a wash. And I think there's some real benefits to the C Corp structure, like we were talking about a couple of weeks ago.
In 2024, it is roughly a wash. The LLC, if you have a simple LLC that's owned by one person, you will pay a few points less with the LLC, a few percentage points less at the top marginal tax rate in your LLC structure than you will in a C Corp structure. But the massive benefit to the C Corp structure, which I did not appreciate until going through this deal either, is that you control the timing. So a very blunt way to break this down is there's like two halves of the tax. There's like the corporate tax and then there's the individual tax. In an LLC structure, the corporate doesn't pay any and the individual functionally pays both halves, right? You pay your marginal top personal rate, 37, 39, whatever it is. But then in the C Corp structure, the corporation pays 21 and then the individual pays 20, right, later. So it's roughly the same tax rate. But the big difference is in the corporate structure, you don't pay the other half until the money comes out of the business. In the LLC structure, you have to pay the full tax drag every single quarter. So you're paying a roughly four, I'm rounding numbers here, but in an LLC structure, you pay 40% tax rate every single quarter. In a C Corp structure, you pay a 20% tax rate, half every quarter, because the corporation has to pay its own taxes. But you don't have to pay the individual half of the taxes until you distribute the money out and then the individuals pay the tax. The key difference there is in an inventory-based business, like an e-commerce business, you get to keep that other half of the tax money in the business, which is really, really powerful. Your effective cash drag of taxes is half in the C Corp structure as it is in the LLC structure. And while you may be paying a couple points more of taxes, how many loans might you need under the LLC structure and what might be the interest rate on the loan? Because you have to replace the money that you paid out to Uncle Sam, because then you need to reborrow it to buy inventory. So I think the C Corp structure is slept on in inventory heavy businesses, especially if you have multiple shareholders.
Hey, Andrew here with a quick sidebar. I want to introduce you to Julia from abarabove.com, where she and her husband and co-founder sell premium mixology products. Julie's been incredible. She's one of our meetup leaders in California and just an amazing human. And here's what she has to say about her experience with the e-commerce fuel private community for 7- and 8-figure owners.
Anytime I hire an agency or use software, I always search ECF first, not just for the specific software that I'm considering, but also on a broader sense, like, does anybody have recommendations? You know, what are you using for this? And on a large number of occasions, the ECF community has mentioned other alternatives that I may not have known about or considered. And as a result, a lot of times I've used those choices. And even better than that, sometimes I even got a discount. So I would say that's definitely the thing I most frequently use about ECF and also probably has provided the most direct benefit.
After hearing literally hundreds of comments like this over the last decade our community's been around, it's easy to offer our 10x guarantee. If you don't get at least a 10x ROI on your membership in the first year, in terms of increased revenue, saved time, and saved money, we'll give you a full refund plus an extra $1,000. but many of our members report seeing massive value in just the first month or two when applying it to their 7 or 8 figure business. You can learn more about the community and apply for membership at ecommercefuel.com. Okay, back to the show. Yeah, and even just from a compounding perspective, right? Like in an LLC, if you take the expense in the year, you need to offset that income, you can take the full write-off, which is nice. But oftentimes how many people have made suboptimal purchases on December 29th to reduce their tax bill? Like we all have, right? Sometimes in very egregious forms and formats, right? You know, a fleet of Ford F-150 Raptors, for example, is something ridiculous. But you think about the C-Corp structure and you're always paying that 20%. But let's say you have some plans for the next year or two for some major investments, but you're not ready to pull the trigger. Well, you can keep half of your tax liability relative to a C-Corp, to a LLC, if you pay 40%, we're just kind of using that as an example or, you know, roughly. And you can keep that in the business in a C-Corp untaxed to redeploy in the future. And you don't have to rush to spend it. And even if you look at an investment perspective too, it's like half, the government give you a pass on paying taxes until you take ownership of the money to reinvest in other places. And that those tax advantage vehicles, of course, always are a huge benefit. So anyway, it was interesting thinking more about that. And you and I we had an interesting discussion about this because carry is how an investment vehicle makes money. The way that ECF Capital is set up is that there's no fees, but the way that I got compensated on the investor side was I would take 25% of profits after investors' capital was returned. And we were talking
commonly
about
commonly known as carry in private equity terms.
Thank you. Carry. Yeah. And so as we're getting kind of ready to put this, as the deal closed and we're ready to calculate this all out, kind of ran all the numbers and everything. And I was calculating the tax distributions that we paid to investors as a return of capital. As though they were profits, but they weren't, because the person, Bill, when you got your return, your tax, you weren't putting that in the bank. You had to pay those taxes, right?
Right. But I was not making any money. I was just turning around and giving it to Uncle Sam. But the initial calculations was as though I had kept that money and it counted towards my rate of return.
Yeah. And then I was thinking about it and you very tactfully were like asking me, does this make sense? I'm not sure if it does. And in my mind, I was like, you know what? I'm not sure if it does fully either, but like also, it also feels weird to not. Anyway, we had an interesting discussion. So the two of us kind of through like a process of just talking about it, figured out that there was this kind of dual hybrid that in the LLC, there's always a liability for the corporation and for the individual. It's just split differently between the LLC and the C Corp. So it's kind of an interesting way to think through the problem.
Yeah. In a classic private equity deal, most classic private equity deals are C Corps, right? So yes. A classic private equity deal, you calculate the return to investors kind of before the investors pay their capital gains tax, right? Because that's their own business, their capital gains tax. And so, Andrew, your initial thought was, you know, we should be calculating, it doesn't matter if this is a tax distribution, right? We disregard taxes for purposes of carry calculation. And I said, but not really, because there's, and then as we went back and forth, you actually eventually cut to it and figured out and got to the correct answer, which is that with an LLC, when you're distributing that tax distribution, it's kind of a double. Half of it is the corporate side and half of it is the individual side. But in a traditional private equity deal, the company, the C Corp, pays its own taxes to the government before the shareholders see any money at all. So carry is calculated post corporate tax, pre individual tax in a traditional C Corp. And so what we had to do is kind of convert an LLC, which was paying out both types of tax all at once, to sort of this half and half. We had to imply a C Corp equivalent IRR in order to, I think, fairly calculate the carry, which is what we ended up doing.
Yeah, it's because like you said, most of these deals are done not with LLCs, but with C Corps. Still makes my head hurt a little bit thinking about it, but we got there.
All told, if I were to do this again, I would do it as a C Corp, hands down. It saves all of the quarterly distributions to all, 20 investors that we had, saves all the different states for all the different investors on their tax returns, makes the carry calculation easier, keeps half the tax bill in the business and avoids that tax drag. I mean, I would say if we had done this as a C Corp, it would have made life way easier. We really should have done that.
Oh yeah, 100%. Yes. But again, then you get back to the problem. And I think this is one of the reasons why people don't invest in these kind of deals, a lot of people think like, oh, hey, like you can buy an e-commerce business for like 3 or 4 times earnings. I'm just going to buy it and just spit off 25% cash. Heck, maybe I double it. Then I'm going to make 50% year over year money. And I think you get into the reality of it. And the switching costs, the time to buy, the time to sell, oftentimes those multiples don't include somebody to run the business because if they're SDE, sales discretionary earnings, they don't include a full-time equivalent salary. You think even about the legal structures, like pooling the money like this, like I mentioned earlier, we're getting a little bit in the weeds, but you can't, I don't think C-Corps can invest into S-Corps, which is, anyway, there's all these things. So I think these, we learned the hard way why some of these deals are not being done more often.
It's very hard to aggregate capital from a lot of people and buy a small business. I mean, if I were to sum it up, like there's just a lot of brain damage that goes into aggregating capital from a lot of folks and buying a small business. And, you know, up and running back to the beginning of the episode, someone needs to personally guarantee the SBA loan, right? And the people who don't guarantee the SBA loan can't be over 20% equity, right? I mean, there's all the tax stuff, all the entity structure stuff we've talked about. It's just really hard. And there is sort of a, if you're going to aggregate capital from a bunch of people and buy a business of any size, there mm-hmm. is sort of a fixed amount of pain in the ass, brain damage overhead and financial overhead. And it's a non-zero number as you experienced administering all of this, Andrew. And if this business were 10 times the size, your brain damage and your actual hard cost would not have been very much higher at all, I don't think. And that's, I think, something that, you know, small sponsors, people who are raising money to buy small businesses don't really see coming. Something we didn't see coming.
And one thing that I realized too, I think, mentioned the SPV. SPV, again, is just an LLC. It's called Special Purpose Vehicle. Fancy way of saying an LLC. A lot of investors use, create, and join to invest in a business with one entry on their cap table as opposed to like 20. There's a lot of different companies out there, or at least some companies that will do this. And man, in the traditional continuing case of my confidence in people in authority going downhill over as I get older, there was a company, and I don't want to throw them under the bus, but they have since... They were well held up in the investment space. A lot of people use them. A lot of well-known venture capitalists use them. And I just assumed they knew what they were doing. And I could trust these guys to put my, to, you know what the rules were, to manage things. Anyway, through the process, realized that it just, as it was an absolute train wreck at this company. They eventually went out of business about halfway through when we had, still had some investments. Anyway, my point being, I think if you're looking for someone, if you're going to do an investment like this, where you can hand off to them, pay them, you know, a small fee, and they manage all the logistical details, I have yet to see a business that does that really well. And even if the one does, you still got to be watching it pretty closely. I think if I was going to do it again, if you have a good CPA, if you have a good lawyer, it's not that crazily complicated to do. There's still work involved in setting up a good operating agreement, which probably is one of the hardest parts for us. Maybe we can talk about that too, Bill, up front. You still have to set that up, and you still have to set up bank accounts and some rules. But doing this again, I would go through the process of probably using, especially if we had fewer investors, just a good CPA, a good accountant, and working with them versus trying to go to one of these shops where you're just, it's an SPV investor mill and they're trying to manage it for you.
Rather than using a productized SPV service, yes, you would just use a lawyer.
Yes, at least with my experience. So, yeah. Bill, what were your thoughts? What were your thoughts on the leverage side? We've always had, like, coming in, you were very comfortable with it. On the back end, I think maybe it was something that was a little more in your mental overhead. So how
I was less comfortable with it by the end.
Because I mean, you guaranteed a $1.8 million note on the business. So yeah, how did that kind of, what were you thinking at the beginning, and what, like, how did that transpire near the end?
So it's very easy. So we're all entrepreneurs, right? If you're listening, you're probably an entrepreneur. Like, we are hardwired for optimism, which is just true. And it's really important to know that about yourself. As I have gotten older, I have not gotten less hardwired for optimism. I have become more aware of my bias for optimism, which is different, right? So I think going into this deal, I allowed my bias for optimism to make me go, this is going to be fine. The coverage, I looked at kind of the monthly payment on the note and the monthly income of the business. There was a huge spread there. And then I said, even if, you know, we can't cash flow, like we could sell this thing, we've got to chew through all the $1.2 million of equity capital raised before the debt doesn't get made whole. You know, I said, I got multiple buffers here, right? There's a bunch of cash flow buffer and there's a pretty big equity buffer in this business, even if we sell it at a loss, which we did not. But even if we had, you know, it would have had to be a very big loss, a 40% loss before debt was impacted at all. So going into it, I felt pretty good. I vividly remember the day I stopped feeling good about it was when our largest supplier for this business, we received a certified letter from our largest supplier, and it said, "We have discovered you are selling our products on Amazon. We do not allow that as part of our supply agreement. You are cut off." The end. And I went, "Oh, well, this business just went to zero. Like overnight, I'm on the hook for $1.8 million. And this was something we had diligenced. We had talked to this supplier and we were like, you knew we were selling it on Amazon. Like where?" So we had a full day of total panic. Call the supplier. The next day they calls back and leave us a voicemail. "Oh, that letter was sent an error. We knew you were selling on Amazon. Don't worry about it." Oh my God. So that day was when I became suddenly less okay, personally guaranteeing the note. And I think the moral of that story is like, shit happens, right? Shit happens in small business. You know, huge body blows happen that you can't always see coming. And then of course, you know, as we were going through this, what, interest rates are going up. The interest rate on our SBA loan went from 5-ish% to 10-ish%, as anybody who is currently carrying an SBA loan has experienced. And that was another, you know, macro lesson that we learned, and I think a lot of people learned also. I don't think a lot of entrepreneurs and people who bought businesses realized how much interest rate risk they were taking in there that was embedded in their floating rate SBA loan, because rates had been zero for a decade, right? Rates didn't go up, you know, like variable rate. What's a variable rate loan? I bet people didn't even know that their SBA loans were variable because they never varied, right? Because rates were zero. And then all of a sudden in 6 months, rate go from 0 to 5% and your SBA loan goes from 5% to 10%, means your payment roughly doubles. And I think a lot of businesses that previously had a lot of buffer suddenly did not. And we were, luckily we had so much buffer that we were still fine, but I've talked to a lot of people who were not.
Yeah. I mean, even on the macro side, not even just interest rates, but from the selling rate, I mean, like when we started the sales process, multiples were very rich. I mean, it's been so long, but I mean, we had offers for 5x, maybe even 6x potentially. I can't remember of our earnings slash, I think it was EBITDA at that point. But by the time, so that's when we started the process. And by the time we wrapped it up, the market was in a radically different place. And so, yeah, I think it's a great point. Like this is why it's so important to stress test your deals. Bill, you and I both have a little bit of a financial modeling background, and putting, you know, we did a lot of financial modeling on the deal so side, like before we even got into this deal, you know, we had a model that was like, okay, well, how are things going to look? How much can we make? We had different assumptions for revenue and profitability and things like that. And even if you do it in a really rudimentary way, I think trying to think through the worst case scenarios on things, be optimistic, but, you know, but plan for the worst kind of thing, is so important. Because man, if and this happened, interest rates double and your exit multiple goes down by 40%, do you still want to do this deal? You know, right? And like, at least
the answer is no for almost any deal in that scenario.
Yeah, you don't need 4 hours of modeling to answer that. You can just answer it off the cuff, huh?
No, if your exit multiple gets cut in half and your interest rate on your loan doubles, you're going to be hurting. Yeah. Kind of period. And yeah. I mean, honestly, the only thing that saved our butts is that we did grow the business. You know, we were able to increase the earnings of the business, which helped.
So we ultimately did sell the business about 6 months. No, man, it's coming up on, I guess, 8 months now. It was last May. Sold the business to a fantastic gentleman. When you look at the IRRs on the deal, we probably made, it was for investors, probably high teens IRR. So like high to mid teens. I can't remember exactly. Bill, do you remember what it was?
It was 16 to 18%, which basically meant that over the 2.5 year hold period, you made an annualized 16%. So it was like making 16% a year for 2.5 years, which means you got roughly 1.5 times your money back in two and a half years.
Yeah, which is like, you know,
yeah, not terrible, return. Right? Important to note, during that time, the S&P 500 returned 2%.
So, oh, that is good. Okay.
Important to note, right? So we crushed the S&P over, which reflects kind of the economic challenges over the period, right? Like the S&P went nowhere, you know, and we delivered a high teens IRR to investors. So I think all of our investors were very happy with us. Our initial models, we thought we would be delivering 30%+, right? 40, 50. I mean, it was looked like a slam dunk. You know, and then macro and market moved against us fairly substantially. And, you know, all credit to Mike and you and the folks at Quiet Light and, you know, everybody that kind of team effort to get it over the finish line and to have a good outcome for people. But it was far from assured because there was so much macro turmoil.
Yeah. I think our original investor pitch on the deal, the one I put together, I think we were targeting high 20s, right? Like 27, 28, 29%, and ended up hitting about 18%. So yeah, it was from an investor perspective, it worked out not as well as we hoped, but reasonably well. Kind of as we start wrapping this one up, Bill, what would you, from my perspective, I still think that there's interesting opportunities and a lot in a very inefficient market. And even just the fact you have the illiquidity of it, if you're willing to take the, if you do things smartly in this field, you can come in and make money with these kind of deals. But I think things I would do differently, in addition to what we've talked about, or maybe even just summarizing what we've talked about, fewer investors. I mean, a lot of the investors that we raised from, I mean, the smallest was 25K, the largest was like 100K from our investor pool outside of what the three of us invested. And it's much easier to do, like all things, it's much easier to do deals with, and huge thank you to our investors, not to you know, and hopefully it doesn't come across as a criticism of any of them. You guys were all of our investors were fantastic. It's easier to do it, just given the corporate structure, it's easier to do it with fewer people. I will say one other lesson I learned from this was when I put together the investor pool for ECF Capital, thankfully I had a lot of good interest in it, but I was very, the investors that I picked, I wanted to make sure I picked people that I had known for a long time and that I thought were very highly reasonable people. Because I think a lot of people listening, if you've ever been in business with other people, if you have investors and you get one unreasonable investor, they can make your life really miserable. And man, such huge kudos to all of our investors. I think all of them were incredibly understanding of different holdups in the process. They were never combative, never had any issues. I think the most high maintenance they were was, you know, maybe an occasional email, how is this going? Or, you know, there was zero high maintenance issues at all. So point for me, one thing I was very thankful I did with this deal and the whole structure for the ECF Capital experiment was having just phenomenal investors and picking your investors carefully. So.
Yeah. And, you know, I think the other things we did is you sent regular investor updates proactively, which was really important. So people didn't feel like they needed to hassle you for updates. We also didn't take so much money from anybody that, you know, we said up front, you could lose this whole investment. You know, do not give us an amount of money that is really material to you, which is really key. Because if you've got somebody with 30% of their net worth in your deal, they're going to be a different level of stress than somebody who's got 1% of their net worth in your deal. So that's another thing I would really emphasize. Don't take enough money from anyone, especially a family member or a close friend, that if they lost it all, they would be very stressed about that.
Yeah. And anything else you would do differently next time, Bill?
Well, I mean, I think the C Corp's a big one. I would do the C Corp. I think, I mean, the ultimate, one of the big things I think that caused us a lot of stress on this deal was that we had a timeline. We went into this deal knowing that we only had Mike for a year. Of course, he ended up staying 2.5 years, which created a lot of stress for everybody. It also meant that we were kind of forced to time the market. Right. If you go into a deal wanting to sell it in 3 years, you are essentially pre-committing to selling into whatever macro environment it is in 3 years, right? Whatever multiples are, whatever interest rates are, however challenging it may be, however great it may be, right? You're essentially trying to time the market, right? You know what your entry multiple is, and you are functionally pre-committing to exiting in at whatever the 3 years market is. And that was what we did. And of course, the timing was not good, right? So then we were trying to get liquid into a market that was not very active and where multiples were not as high as we wish they had been. So if you go into it, I would strongly advise going into it with an indefinite timeline, because the way that you make money, it's like obviously stupid, is to buy low and sell high, right? So what you want to do is to buy at a good price and then wait until the market is hot. And that's when you sell. But if you are forced to sell into the down market, you're going to have a hard time.
Yeah, I agree. It was, I will say, when I look at it from an investor perspective, like the actual equity capital I invested, getting a 17-18% return was great. Very happy about that. When I looked at it from a business perspective, ECF capital, in terms of the amount of fees earned relative to the time put in, was not a great trade-off. But the lessons that I learned from this business, from, we didn't even get into operating agreement, but from risk, from deal structure, from market timing, from just so many things, I would do the deal again, knowing how it worked out, just for the education that came with it. And so for me, like, man, I just the reps having that there to make better decisions in the future for some of those structural aspects was by far the most valuable thing I got out of this whole experience.
Which is why they always say, right, like the best MBA is running a business. Like, yeah, like we made an okay rate of return, but priceless lessons, right, that you only learn by doing. You know, like the next deal that we do, we will avoid all of these pitfalls, right? And do even better than we did.
And make a bunch of other mistakes we don't even know are
exactly
out there yet.
Well, which is why reps and experience is so, so key, right? And that's why it's important to have people around you, to on your board, on your investor list, as advisors who have been there and done it a bunch of times, because you learn, you step on different landmines every single time. So to have someone, you know, or a group of people around your business that have been through 10 cycles, right, can really bail you out.
Yeah. Huge thank you to Michael Jackness again. Michael, thank you for man, just all the patience, hard work, and flexibility on this deal. Couldn't have made it happen without you. To our awesome investors from ECF Capital, to Quiet Lake, Chris at Quiet Lake, we didn't mention him by name, but he just did a phenomenal deal. Phenomenal job getting this deal done. Yeah. So it's at one point he put together just like an insanely massive spreadsheet with all the pro forma calculations for our new supply chain that the new buyer could plug in, just went above and beyond. So I got it done. So Chris, thank you. And Bill, to you too, man. Thank you for your expertise coming in for underwriting that 1.8 mil note and just the whole, yeah. I mean, doing the deal with you, me, and Mike, it was cool to have us be able to come in as friends, leave as friends. I don't know if I'd always recommend to people doing deals with really good friends, but in this case, I think our track record and our history helped us get through some harder times, which was cool. So thank you for all, your flexibility and work on it too, man. I really appreciate it.
Well, I mean, I'll say, you know, people always say, be careful doing deals with friends. And I don't think it's so much that you shouldn't do deals with friends, is that you should be very careful, because when you do a deal with friends, you're going to be forced at some point to decide whether you want to preserve the friendship or whether you want to put business first. And, you know, it came to us to the three of us, you, me, and Mike. You know, Mike had been in it for so long. We had asked many things of him that were unfair, that were beyond what we said we would ask of him, right? But the way our contract was, we were not obligated to pay him for that. But then you and I kind of put our heads together and we made the decision to give Mike a substantial bonus that he was not contractually entitled to, right? But to do the right thing, because we decided that we were going to be friends first, right? Rather than business partners first. And I think that is what allowed us to come out of it as friends too. Like, we repeatedly put, you know, relationships first over kind of what was right. We put that first over kind of absolute to the letter, you know, of a contract, and everybody still did great and we preserved the friendship. But there were plenty of opportunities to screw up that friendship also.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think everyone at various stages, and I think Mike probably gave the most, if I had to say, in terms of where deviating from what he was planning to do. But at various points, all of us had to give way in some area where we're not expecting, or where, you know, it was not up to the plan. And we all needed to have, there was a lot of flexibility required of all of us. And I think the fact that we were able to be flexible because we valued the relationships the most and put those above 100%. That's what helped us get through everything and be able to, you know, we had a great time. We kind of, we all got together. We were able to celebrate it a couple months ago. And man, it was super fun hanging out. We were all able to hang out as good of, if not better, friends at the end of it versus the beginning, which is, I wouldn't say is always the story of going into business with friends. Yeah.
It's not. So it's going to go in, because business, even if you do a deal that goes perfectly, it's still stressful. Like there are, you're going to be, even if you have the exact same, you know, class of stock and everything, you're going to have disagreements about whether you should do this or whether you should do that. You know, you're going to have it. So when you go into business with friends, you put the friendship on the line, period. Don't convince yourself that, oh, I can put the friendship over here and the business over here, and I can do this deal with a friend and not gamble the friendship. I'm not saying you're going to lose the friendship, but you are gambling the friendship. It is in play. It is in the pot. The friendship is in the pot. So going into that, knowing that going in, I think is very key. Remembering that while you are in it will change the way you act, because you will know that not only is the business in the pot, the friendship is in the pot. And it might hopefully lead you to act differently with your friends and partners than if they were just business partners.
Yeah. And one thing that was interesting too, just kind of a final note here. On my side, you know, I was the one legally representing the interests of the investors, right? And so a lot of things that we were doing too, it was kind of a walk between making sure I took care of their interests while also managed kind of like the relationships between the three of us. And then a lot of times they're aligned, right? Like if things go south between the three of us in that deal, it would not be good for investors, right? So there's an alignment there a lot. But it's always interesting. I mean, anytime, one thing this deal also gave me a sense of is anytime you take money from someone, man, you just, if you've never done it before, I think it's hard to overstate just the sense of obligation you have to people when you take a meaningful amount of their money. Like whether it's from investment business or investing in other things, like it's just, think through it carefully. And not to say you shouldn't do it, and it can work out really well and it can make things happen, and I don't regret doing it, but it does bring a level of responsibility and burden that, yeah, you want to take seriously and weigh against other things too. So that was another kind of factor in that whole mix. So thank you again, everyone. Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Quiet Light, our investors. Bill, man, thanks for going through this together. It was fun. It was scary at times. It was crazy, but glad we got one in the rear view, and super fun to get on here and debrief with you. And you, I think you have, before we kind of call it a day here, you're doing some cool stuff. You've got I got a newsletter from you yesterday that was super fantastic. I know you're doing some consulting for people. Talk a little bit about what you got going on in addition to obviously you have Natural Dog Company, but what else are you up to these days?
All right. So if you've made it an hour into this podcast, you are probably interested in e-commerce and small business finance and acquisitions. So if you're interested in those things, my goal is to write the very best newsletter on the internet about those three things. You can subscribe. It's list.buildda.com. I send it once a week. It's from me. I write it. It's great. And then also, as I mentioned earlier, sometimes it can be helpful to have someone who's gone 10 rounds, you know, to help you know where the potholes are. I do a limited amount of consulting with one-to-one with CEOs. I only take 4 people at once. I have 1 slot open right now. So if you have a business, my typical best clients are kind of north of 5 million in sales. But if you have a business and you think it would be helpful to kind of have a board of directors, but who can't fire you, that would be helpful to you, just drop me a note, bill@buildda.com.
I strongly recommend the newsletter. So I was reading it this week and it is fantastic. So make sure to check it out. Bill, always love doing these shows with you, man. Thanks so much. Thanks for the time. And we will talk to you next time.
Glad to be here. See everybody at ECF Live.
That's going to do it for this week. A big thank you to OneClick Upsell, who offers incredible upsell software to get more from every single customer and increase your average order value on your site. To make more money from the customers you already have, check them out at ecommercefuel.com/upsell. And if you own a 7 or 8 figure store, you really should be a part of our private community and forums here at eCommerce Fuel, where you can connect with over 1,200 store owners just like you. We're so confident it'll be a game changer that we offer a 10x ROI guarantee. If you don't see 10x your membership value in the first year, we'll refund you 100% of your membership fees plus toss in an extra $1,000 for the hassle. So you can learn more and apply at ecommercefuel.com. Thanks so much for listening. Work hard, adventure often, and look forward to seeing you again next Friday.